For Friday, March the 2nd, 2007, we've got two bills up for public hearing and possible work session, and we'll take them in the order in which they're listed. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2300. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2300 relates to clarification of language regarding the denial and revocation of concealed handgun licenses. Summarize the issue as briefly as possible. ORS 166.291, .292, and .293 discuss concealed handgun licenses. 166.291 and .292 establish the procedures to obtain and to issue licenses. 166.293 relates to the denial and revocation of licenses. Subsection 2 of 166.293 establishes one ground for denying a license as, in short, anytime the sheriff has reasonable grounds to believe that the applicant is a danger to himself or others, as demonstrated by the applicant's past pattern of behavior. Without going into hyper-technical detail on this issue, there was an amendment in 2003 that changed subsection 3A of ORS 166.293. This change was intended to be merely non-substantive and just clarifying language. The Oregon Court of Appeals disagreed, however. In the case of Bates versus Gordon, 201 or App 619, the court found that a 2003 amendment to language invalidated subsection 2 of ORS 166.293 as a grounds for revoking a license. House Bill 2300 is meant to address this issue, and it amends ORS 166.293 3A to clarify that any act or condition that would prevent the issuance of a concealed handgun license is cause for revoking a concealed handgun license. I'm sure that was all very clear.
There you have it, the technical background. We have a couple of witnesses signed up. First, Tammy Wood from the Linn County Sheriff's Office.
I'm ready to vote.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Tammy Wood. I'm a captain with the Linn County Sheriff's Office in Albany. I'm a division commander of the Civil Division, and part of my responsibilities are issues dealing with concealed handgun licenses. I'm also the secretary of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Civil Command Council. I'm here today to urge your support of House Bill 2300. House Bill 2300 fixes an unintentional problem created by the legislature in 2003 and Senate Bill 81. More commonly known as the Revisers Bill, it meant to make some technical changes such as grammar and punctuation. The Legislative Council inserted notes at the end of the section to explain what those changes were meant to do, and that note read that it eliminated needless series references in subsection 3 and subsection 6. However, that was much broader than they intended. It eliminated the sheriff's ability to revoke people for danger to self and others. For an example for you, a concealed handgun license holder came to my attention in 2004 after the law changed. Previous to that, he'd had no derogatory contact with police, or there were no indications that he would have any problems. He was being disciplined by his employer for bringing his handgun onto the employer's property, which was in violation of the rules. The investigation into that incident, and later during disciplinary proceedings, he made vile threats. He told people the supervisor was going to end up like the former DOC director, Michael Franke. He said he had nothing to lose and would do whatever it took to convince the supervisor that he meant business. He told other employees he was going to project a laser sighting device on one of his guns onto the chest of his supervisor just to show how far he was prepared to go. He felt he was being framed and that someone had stolen the handgun from his home and planted it in his property on the employer's property. He told another employee after he was disciplined over the phone that she didn't have to worry about being shot. She would be spared because he liked her. Although none of this rose to the level of committing a crime, Oregon State Police did issue an officer safety bulletin. After his termination, I received a report from the Department of Homeland Security after his behavior at the local Social Security office spooked the employees. By 2005, he had become delusional. He was seeing things that weren't there and not seeing others that were. And the local police often responded regarding his veiled threats and other comments to his neighbors. In spite of all of this, the statute does not allow us to revoke him. This bill does not allow the sheriffs any broader power to revoke. For 10 years until 2003, we had that ability. We're just simply asking to have it restored. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Captain Wood. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Brian Wallace from the Marion County Sheriff's Office.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Wallace, and I'm the Chief Civil Deputy at the Marion County Sheriff's Office located at 100 High Street Northeast in Salem. I'm also the former president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Civil Command Council. I am here today on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Marion County Sheriff, Raul Ramirez, to testify in support of House Bill 2300, and I thank you all for this opportunity. Without regurgitating what legislative counsel has already read and what my colleague has already stated, House Bill 2300 simply is a bill that just corrects an unintentional technical glitch made two sessions ago. Like Captain Wood was advising, that bill not only was to fix grammar, it deleted obsolete provisions and conformed language, and now, as a result, is responsible for hindering a sheriff's ability to revoke a concealed handgun license holder if the holder or licensee is a danger to themselves or others. Real quick, as it is right now, sheriffs can, I'll just refer to that 166.293 as the danger clause without repeating the whole statute. But as it is right now, a sheriff has the ability to deny an application when somebody first applies or when somebody renews their license. The sheriff can deny for the danger clause. However, if a holder has dealings or run-ins with police and then qualifies for the danger clause, the sheriff's hands are tied, and it just simply doesn't make any sense whatsoever for a sheriff to be able to deny, but then if somebody, you know, has behavioral problems or issues with law enforcement or with, like Tammy stated, with an employer or whomever, any citizen of this state, the sheriff says, well, you know, because of Bates versus Gordon in the Court of Appeals, we're unable to pull your license. It doesn't make any sense. So you can meet a certain threshold at the beginning when you apply, but that doesn't apply as you hold the license. It doesn't work with driver's licenses, and it certainly shouldn't work with concealed handgun licenses. Again, what is proposed is merely restoring the previous ability for the sheriff to revoke a license. And right now, two words are really the issue, like I just hit on, revoke versus deny. And like I said, it doesn't make sense that you can deny, but you can't revoke. In order to correct this, this bill is good in the sense that it eliminates statutory reference altogether. To simply state any act or condition that would prevent the issuance of a concealed handgun license is cause for revoking a concealed handgun license, whereas before it said any act or condition that would prevent the issuance of a license under 166.291 and 292. The previous statute to close did state any act or condition that would prevent the issuance of a license under 166.291 to 293 is cause for revoking a concealed handgun license. So prior to 2003, again, the sheriff had the ability to, in a sense, revoke for that danger clause. The Court of Appeals, to just really briefly summarize what they stated with the Bates versus Gordon, Gordon being Sheriff Rob Gordon of Washington County, was that the plain language of the existing statute was clear, as well as the legislature's intent, whether intentional or unintentional, and it did delete that ability for a sheriff to revoke. And the sheriffs are, quite frankly, caught in the middle trying to do what is prudent and just to keep the community safe. I request a do-pass recommendation in order to clarify everything for all sheriffs and other stakeholders. And finally, to close, I just want to say that it is indeed the goal of and mission of all law enforcement agencies to properly enforce the law, to maintain the peace and dignity for the citizens of this state, and to ensure that citizens are safe from those who unfortunately meet the qualifications under the danger clause, whether or not they currently have a concealed handgun license. I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify before you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Are there any questions for Mr. Wallace? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
That concludes the testimony we had witnesses signed up for, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2300. And open a work session on House Bill 2300. Members, I think we get the picture here. It's just one of those consequences of a little drafting glitch in our process that had some unintended consequences, and this puts it right. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2300 to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2300 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion.
Is there any discussion? And Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we'll blame this on the ones that were here in 2003,
unfortunately includes a couple of us members.
I came after the session, remember. Did the revoking, is that pretty well still clear? There's nothing we need to touch or tweak in the revoking procedure? Is that?
It's fine.
It's my understanding, too, that the Court of Appeals case that identified the problem had since been reversed by the Supreme Court, so that it arguably it's okay even the way it is, but why leave it to any issue of doubt? I mean, there are people out there who might try, looking for any ground they have for a challenging or a revocation, then we might as well clean up the language.
My question was, before we changed it in ERA, was there was procedures for the sheriff couldn't just, on his own, there was had to be some documentation hearing.
Right. That's why you got that case. Yeah. I mean, somebody did. There is ability to challenge that.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici, excused.
Excused.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Excused.
Representative Hong?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnick?
Aye.
Chairman Forsyth?
Aye. House Bill 2300 moves to the floor, and members, this is just a technical matter that seems like it could go on the consent calendar, unless you think the subject matter is such that it needs explanation on the floor.
I don't think it does.
I don't think that's what we're missing. Two people is the only thing where the reason I didn't recommend that in my motion.
Right. As long as it's unanimous among those who are here, I think we're fine. So. Without objection, I will recommend that this be placed on the consent calendar. House Bill 2300 moves to the floor, then do pass. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2300 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2311.
Well, there goes our audience.
Council Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2311 comes to you at the request of the House Interim Judiciary Committee for the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, Oregon Collectors Association, Judicial Department, Oregon Justices of Peace Association, the Oregon Municipal Judges Association. Eliminates the court facilities and local court facilities account, sets the interest rate, the statutory rate, allows the state court administrator to waive interest for the purpose of administering collection of judgments for state courts, allows the municipal court judge and justice of the peace to do the same, states that all payments are first applied to principal, allows monies collected in interest state and the court to be used to pay costs of collection, and that monies left over are paid to the criminal injuries compensation account. If it's a local court, the monies would go to the general fund of the local government.
Thank you, Council. Judge Lemhouse, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jad Lemhouse, Justice of the Peace, Linn County Justice of the Peace Court, District 4A. I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2311, and I've prepared a couple of exhibits to illustrate the testimony that I'm going to be discussing with you this morning. There are two pages on the exhibit, and I'd like to start with the first page because the first page is intended to illustrate the problem that we're facing. Essentially, in 1999, there was a law that was passed that would require courts to begin charging interest on criminal judgments and then to apportion the interest in certain ways. We fairly quickly discovered that there was a problem in that it was unlikely that we were going to be able to do that with the software and computing abilities that most of the courts had at that point in time. We therefore came to the legislature at a later time and asked for a 4-year delay in implementing that legislation. And unfortunately, I'm here to tell you this morning that the situation is basically unchanged. We still can't do it. There's simply no way we can come up with a system to charge and apportion interest in the manner provided in 1999 Orlaws 1064. I believe, Mr. Taylor, that that's the correct statutory reference. If not, feel free to correct me. The example that I'm using to illustrate the problem is a conviction for a Class A misdemeanor known as reckless driving. It's fairly common, and in this particular instance, the judgment is entered in a justice court following a jury trial. In fact, this example was suggested to me by a trial over which I presided in the Reedsport Justice Court in November of last year. The numbers are not exactly the same. And in fact, one of the things that I inadvertently left out of this example was another category of the money judgment that would be cost to cover the cost of indigent defense, which would be an item of cost that would be listed on Table 1 and in Table 2. And what Table 1 illustrates is how the judgment total is broken down according to the different categories of assessments and fines that are imposed. In this example, there was injuries to both property and persons, and so there's a fairly large restitution judgment in the amount of $3,500. There's also a fine of $1,000, and then two statutory assessments, the unitary assessment of $67 and the county assessment of $66. So the total ends up being $4,633, and at the 9% interest rate that is established by Oregon Revised Statute 82.010, that's a 9% rate, and so on an annual accrual rate, the judgment would accrue $416.97 per year, or $1.42 per day until the judgment's paid. Now, let's assume that the individual in question starts paying the judgment. We're charging interest, and when we receive a payment, the courts then have to distribute the payments according to these various categories that are set up by statute and pay them in the series in which the statute prioritizes those payments to be made. And if you look on Table 2, you'll notice that we've got, just in this example, seven different categories or pots that we have to pour money into at different points in time. That's without any interest at all. Now, if we're going to charge interest on these, then The rule is that interest gets paid first. Whenever a payment is made on a judgment, the first dollar of that payment goes to satisfy whatever outstanding interest there is. The way the law is set up in 1999 Oar Laws Chapter 1064 is that interest follows principal, and so each of these seven different accounts are accruing interest. And so in addition to the seven pots for the principal, we now have seven different pots for interest. And because each of these seven pots for principal have a different priority with respect to the other pots, so does the interest. But we have to pay interest first. And so we're filling these seven interest pots before we can start to fill any of those principal pots, and then they get filled in a specific order. We can't figure out how to do it. Well, our software consultants can't figure out how to do it. And so what we're asking to do is to be allowed to simplify this process and to have a single recipient of interest. And then in this bill also to allow payments to first be applied to principal. Reverse the common law rule. Have interest first, or have payments first applied to principal, to do two things. One, it reduces the time, the total time for payment, and two, it reduces the total amount of interest that would be paid. Once the principal is paid off, then all has to be paid from that point on is the interest, the unpaid interest. We think that'll work. Our software consultants tell us that we can probably do that. As it is right now, we've got a kind of a gun at our head, so to speak, that's going to go off on July 1st of 2007, and there's nothing we can do. We can't do what the statute tells us to do. And one of the things courts like to do is follow the law. We can't follow the law.
Judge Limhouse, one of the changes that's made by the bill, as I read it, is to change from the split rate of interest that is described in the deleted language here on page 1, which was interest at 12.5% per annum from entry for the first 5 years and then 4% thereafter, and which was designed to be sort of a kind of an incentive for early payment. Under the new language in the new line 12, the new line 1, it would be interest at the rate in ORS 82.010, which looks to be a 9% rate. The reason why that split rate was arrived at was because it was in connection with the change that was made on restitution judgments to extend their duration to 50 years, and the concern that a 9% rate would be, which doesn't bear necessarily any relationship to the long-term value of invested dollars, would distort the magnitude of restitution judgments. Now, I realize that as applied to smaller amounts that are criminal fines, that we don't want to complicate your lives and who are trying to administer our criminal judgments, but as applied to restitution, where the damage caused by an offender might be tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars, to run those out for 50 years is a lot of economic distortion. Do you have any comments on that perspective?
Well, there are two things. One is that by paying the principal, having payments be applied to principal first, as long as this offender is making payments on principal, then they're not paying any interest. And if it takes 50 years for them to pay the principal off, then they've never paid any interest. In a judgment, in a large judgment that you're talking about, a $100,000 or more judgment, even at $100 a month, they're only paying that off at $1,200 a year. And so it's going to take a fairly long time at $100 a month to pay that judgment off. If we're applying the payments first to principal, then interest doesn't become a question. The other thing is that what could be done, if this is a concern, then the interest rate for restitution could drop once the monetary obligation for the rest of the criminal judgment expires after 20 years. Judgments and criminal actions are enforceable. The money part of the judgment is enforceable only for a 20-year period after the date of the judgment. And so what could be done, if this is a continuing concern, is we could drop that interest after the expiration of the other parts of the judgment.
I think the bill gives discretion to waive interest, but it doesn't. There's no waiver as of right, and so unless the court acted to waive interest, then what would happen is the offender would be paying off the principal first at whatever rate they're paying off. And there would be interest accruing on whatever that unpaid balance is at 9% under this bill, and they would be paying off for that much longer than what the current law language prescribes, which is at a 12.5% rate for the first few years and then 4% thereafter. So I'm just is there a reason why it has to go to a flat 9% instead of a split rate that's higher to begin with and a lower rate thereafter, but still using that ordering rule where you pay principal first?
I think maybe another witness will address this particular issue as well, but as I understand it, anytime you have multiple rates or multiple payees, you have a level of complication that becomes very difficult to work with. That's the understanding that I have. I'm not a software engineer. I'm certainly not a mathematician. But what I'm told is that when you have multiple rates and multiple recipients, then each time you add a complication, it adds a level of complexity to whatever program is going to be used that makes it much more problematic as to whether or not it can actually function properly. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, also, if we're dealing with an individual, as you're aware, the statute as proposed would allow courts discretion to waive interest. Mm-hmm. If we're dealing with an individual who has performed regularly over an extended period of time to satisfy his or her obligations under the terms of the judgment, most courts, if not all courts, would entertain an application to waive interest after an extended period of time where a person has made a genuine good faith effort to satisfy their obligation. This is what we're seeking to have that discretion to address. The circumstance, we don't want to have people to pay large interest obligations when they have consistently demonstrated good faith by making regular payments over extended periods of time to satisfy the principal obligations.
Any other questions for Judge Lindhouse?
Not at this time.
Okay. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still trying to figure out how to state my question. I know there's another bill that talks about, that's coming down the road, about court funding facilities. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned that I guess my concern is that these are the people that are using our court facilities. These judgments are made to or against or whatever. And I can't imagine that. I mean, there's got to be a way, such as an escrow account, that we all participate in selling or buying property and those kinds of things, where if somebody is assessed, in your example here, a certain amount of money, that I guess maybe this is, you're right, might be complicated, but there's got to be a way we could simplify so that interest could come into those accounts and be set aside and not have to go necessarily to all these other accounts. We don't have to split up that interest. We could, couldn't we just make that interest go into one big account and not give it, split it all up and try to track it so that it could go towards court facilities? Because I know what this bill does is it eliminates that court facilities, and our courts are falling apart. I think this is an example of where those fees that should be collected and be charged apply to those facilities versus some of the other bills that I've seen where we're going to raise taxes on every business in the state to pay for court facilities. So I guess I'd like to have some further discussion as to has this been really vented in a work group before we take away the ability to pay for our court facilities from the people who are actually using them? Has it really been vented that there's no possible way we could simplify the statute so that we could develop some software to make this happen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, the proposal in this particular statute would take those funds that are collected on interest from judgments in circuit courts and pay it to the criminal injuries compensation account. That was a compromise position that was arrived at through a work group that studied this issue during the past couple of years and trying to resolve ways that this existing statute that's taking effect in July could be simplified so that we could make it work. As far as the courts are concerned, I think that the justice of municipal courts and circuit courts are pretty much in line on this. We don't care what you do with the money. We just want to make it simple so that we can do it. And that's what this bill does. It makes it simple so that we can do it, or simple enough so it's not simple. Simple enough so that we can actually do it. And the bill segregates, makes it easier for us still by saying, okay, if the interest is owed on a judgment in a municipal court, then the city can apply that however it wishes. If it wants to use it for court funds, it can do it for court facilities, it can. The same thing in the justice court. If the county wants to use those funds for court facilities, it can. And on the interest that is paid by in the circuit courts, what you folks decide to do with that interest is fine with me. I just want to make sure we get something that works. And right now, the law that's going to take effect on 7107 is not going to work. We can't do it.
Follow up, if I may. Was that the same work group? Who was part of that work group?
myself, Paul Snyder, Kingsley Click, and I think two other persons from the Judicial Department. There was a person from the Department of Justice who stood working with victims, crime victims. Paul Snyder has the comprehensive list, but it was a fairly broad-based work group. There's also a software programmer who was part of the work group that provides software for many of the justice and some of the municipal courts in the state. So we have some technical expertise as well as just stakeholders, so to speak, in the court system.
Just one more follow-up. Is that the same work group that put together the other or recommended the other bill that funds the state court facilities?
No, sir.
So we're not talking to each other in that particular case. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Lindhouse. We have two more witnesses signed up. Paul Snyder and Matt Marquis. Do you want to come up together, gentlemen?
Mr. Chair, I wonder if Kingsley Click from the Judicial Department could join us.
Yeah, that would be fine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association Board and Counties, and House Bill 2317 in 1999 is the bill that's causing the difficulties that Judge Lemhouse has so well described to you. It was our bill, and Judicial Department and we together requested that bill to be introduced. We thought it was a good idea at the time because it would begin a small revenue stream for court facilities. And it came from a work group that we had jointly created with the Judicial Department back, well, before 1999. I think we started in 1993 trying to come up with different solutions to court facilities issues. But that work group came up with that proposal, and the bill was passed, and the issues began to emerge. One of the problems was that 1999 was just before Oregon went into a rather deep recession. And the revenue streams that we thought were going to be available for things like the Oregon Judicial Information Network never materialized. And the hope that they would be able to make the calculations that law would call for began to fade. Then we created another work group similar to the one that Judge Lemhouse has described. in 2002. That work group came up with a recommendation to you that we postpone this effective date for another 4 years. We still weren't ready to just let it go. We still wanted a little bit of time to see if we can come up with some mechanism to make this work. And then Senate Bill 47 passed, postponing the effective date until July of 2007. We put together the similar work group again this last interim, and that's what resulted in House Bill 2311. And it's the result of a number of compromises. But as well, with respect to Representative Cameron's question, although it's not the same work group, there's a great deal of overlap between the court facilities work group that's proposed some legislation to you that I hope you'll consider this session, and the people who worked on House Bill 2311, staff for Association of Oregon County, staff for the Judicial Department, and some other folks were involved with both these work groups. So we're of the view, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this 2311 involves some compromises. The victims' rights issues that were represented by the Department of Justice, there was a feeling that by postponing until I think the year 2012, the calculation and posting of interest to crime victims would allow the Judicial Department enough time to put together the software and the programming so that that could be accomplished. In the meantime, though, that money still would go, the interest still would go for the benefit of crime victims. It just wouldn't be posted to individual crime victims in that judgment. It would be posted to the crime victims' compensation account. So the interest would still, between now and 2012, would still flow for the benefit of victims. It just wouldn't be posted to those individual judgments. After 2012, it would. So that, Mr. Chair and member, is how we got to where we are. We still obviously have major issues with respect to court facilities, and we have proposals that we'll be bringing to you this session about those. We hope you'll consider them favorably. But House Bill 2311, we gave it our best shot, and the experts told us this is what they can do.
Who's next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association. We did partake in the work group and are supportive of the bill. There's been a lot of talk about interest rates, and in meeting with our group of private collection agencies, they're very concerned about the split interest rate and how they might program that as well. So as you see in the bill, it is a 9% interest rate, and on these criminal judgments, it would go for 50 years. We would like to suggest maybe a compromise that you would limit that to 20 years, just like in civil actions. And speaking with the Crime Victims Assistance section over at DOJ this morning, they reminded me that Senator Walker has introduced a bill, and whether or not this moves to this body or not, I don't know, but it would require that interest not be charged on criminal actions when somebody is incarcerated. So they would like to see something. If we went to somewhere where we're limiting it to 20 years, they would like that 20 years not necessarily to start at day one from the judgment, but maybe since that judgment's good for 50 years, and if someone was incarcerated for 10 of the interest would then start, you know, the day after the 10th year when they were released. I think you could just say simply, you know, the interest accrues at that rate for a period of not more than 20 years, and give some discretion then to the governing body as to when that is charged. Mr. Chair, other than that, I'd just be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
It seems to me when we passed the 50-year limit a few
2 years
two years ago, we were concerned about the loss to the victim of a major loss where it would take 50 years to pay it back. Or there was an example of some younger man burned down a building here in Salem, and it was a huge debt, and so we wanted to make the victim whole, and that's why that piece was there. And I don't want to detract from the innocent party who has the loss, but I understand we don't also want to I mean, we want people to be able to pay these judgments off.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I think I totally agree with you. I think that the question has been is if you charge interest for 50 years, is that necessarily fair? That's something that you would have to determine yourselves. I was just trying to offer a compromise that might work for everybody. I think the important thing is that there's lots of circumstances now when no interest is being charged and essentially you're giving a free loan to somebody, and I don't think you want to do that.
And Mr. Yes. Chair, maybe you could remind me. We structured that so that it was 9% early on, and then after a time it went down so the obligation wouldn't just turn out to be a...
It was the split rate that is in the section that this bill would delete was the result of that work 2 years ago. It was, to begin with, the idea was to try to quantify for restitution judgments the real economic loss the victim had suffered. And then, because some of us who believe that quantifying that in an accurate way and having it a stated obligation for the person who owes the judgment is a positive, potentially at least, a positive aspect of the rehabilitation of that individual to understand what loss they've caused and have them pay it off. But if you pick an arbitrary flat rate like 9%, which at least in recent years has been substantially higher than what the real borrowing cost of money is, then over a long period of time, you know, if you extend that over 30 or 40 or 50 years, the interest component becomes the whole, you know, most of the whole thing. It's like a 30-year mortgage. When you just think about how much is principal and how much is interest when you're paying that mortgage off, and the interest rate changes have such a significant impact on how much you end up paying. Mm-hmm. So a flat 9% for a restitution judgment is, at least in recent years, is overstating by a substantial amount what the real economic loss is that the victim, the offender has caused and the victim has suffered. So to go to a flat 9% on a 50-year judgment just doesn't work economically in terms of what we're trying to accomplish with restitution judgments. And I can understand that many of these are not paid and that we need to get something you can practically administer, but I don't know that going back to the to there is a good way. Senator Cameron, did you have something?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that 9% has recently been overstated. I know... commercial loans have been, you know, they float, but they've been in the 7 to 9% range. So, you know, and you know, I understand that there are times when, and it depends on what the damages have been caused, and you know that whole thing, and if there is a way to have flexibility. But I think it is important that the restitution would be able to represent what the actual damages are done, and you know, in the case of if it was to a personal residence or if it was to a commercial residence, the cost of borrowing money is for those victims is two different numbers. So I don't know how you get to that that fairness.
Well, and my original suggestion when the extension of restitution judgments to 50 years came before us 2 years ago was that it be a floating rate that reflected the actual cost of borrowing money over time, and I was told that couldn't be administered, and I was told that the 12.5% and then 4% could be. So this was already kind of a rough cut to try and reflect the sort of practicalities of calculating interest, but apparently it doesn't work either. So we're kind of back at that same kind of challenge that we've, you know, as I have no problem with the 9%. A lot of simplifying kind of efforts when you're talking about sort of your standard criminal fine and you're trying to figure out what happens to it and give people an incentive to pay it off soon. I think that makes perfect sense. But when you're trying to quantify a victim's loss and set that out as a marker as part of the rehabilitation of an offender, I think using an interest rate that's just too rough cut, and in many environments, not always, overstated, is troublesome. So I'd invite comments, or we're kind of a little dialogue here, but I'd like to get reactions from the panel.
Mr. Chairman, if I might address that, I think that one of the things that this bill does to help ameliorate the situation that you're describing is first we apply whatever payments are received to principal, not to interest. The scenario, the typical scenario is that interest gets paid first, and so on a large money judgment, almost regardless of what reasonable amount a person is going to be able to pay, and very few offenders can afford to pay more than $100 a month, you're never going to pay the interest off. It's always going to accrue at a faster rate in terms of absolute dollars than you're going to be able to pay off. You're only at $100 a month, you can pay $1,200 a year. If you've got a 9% judgment and you've got a 9% interest and you have a $100,000 judgment, you're paying $9,000 a year just in interest. And so your interest is going to continue to pile up at such a rate that you'll never even address principal at that rate of payment. And so what we're trying to accomplish here is avoiding that situation. And the other thing is that if you wish to include something that would guide the discretion of the court, for example, an extended payment history where the offender has demonstrated good faith, conditions of indigence, to help guide the court's discretion in exercising the ability to waive the payment of interest, that's probably something you could probably do. But as I said, the fact that this legislation allows interest to be deferred until after all the principal is paid is a significant savings both in terms of cost to the offender, and it actually gets the victims their money first because they have a high priority.
Counsel Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could direct this question to Ms. Click. From what I remember, 4 years ago, we froze this bill because the applicability date of this bill, and we put it off until July because the costs of administering the program were greater than the monies that would have been raised that would have gone into the court account. Is that correct?
Chair McPherson, Counsel Taylor, mostly correct. It was the cost of reprogramming a financial system that was over 20 years old and probably incapable, even if we tried, of being fixed, and that's where the cost part came in. The only other alternative would be some sort of manual.
Okay. So in July, you will have to, if we do not do something here, you will have to put this money into the court account for the purposes of refurbishing courts. At the same time, you will have to, from another account, have to pay for the process of doing this. Is that correct? And my assumption is that the cost of the process of doing this will be greater than the monies that you'll be putting into the court accounts.
Chair McPherson, Counsel Taylor, it would be a bigger problem than that. We would not be able to meet the July 1st, 07 deadline.
Mr. Chair, I guess I have to weigh in here. I have, first of all, if someone from the panel would clarify for me, the unity assessment and county assessment, where does that go? Is there any limitations on the county's use of that money, and what's the unitarian assessment in the judge's table one?
Mr. Chairman, may I answer that question, Mr. Wisnot? The unitary assessment is an amount that is imposed in every criminal action upon conviction, and it is paid to the criminal fine and assessment account regardless of the court in which the assessment is imposed. The county assessment, it's somewhat a misnomer. It actually consists of three different accounts now. There is the traditional county assessment, there is the law enforcement medical liability account, and there is the state court facility security account. The monies that are collected for the state court facilities account are paid to the Oregon Judicial Department, regardless of the court in which the funds are collected. The monies for the law enforcement medical liability account are paid to the Department of Revenue and then distributed according to statute, regardless of which court the funds are collected in. The remaining portion of the county assessment is paid to the county treasurer, who then distributes those funds 60% to adult and juvenile corrections and approved alcohol and drug programs within the county, and 40% for the court facilities security account, which is a fund that is maintained to provide security primarily for the circuit courts in the county.
Thank you, Judge. Follow on, Mr. Chair.
You may.
Okay, let me throw something out here. I do not have a degree in accounting or business or law. Judge, you have the authority on all these fines. Couldn't you just add the interest in and don't call it interest and up the penalties here and just, you know, say it's, you know, the fine is $1,000 plus $500 carrying or something and not call it interest, and then it's not, we don't have to worry about this.
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Wisnot, we don't quite have that latitude of discretion. In criminal actions, we can impose only those kinds of sanctions that are allowed by statute, which basically are fine or incarceration in terms of criminal actions. We do have some leeway with, for example, community service, and sometimes we have what are known as mandatory minimums that we must impose. And so,
but there's no maximum, right?
Yes, there are always maximums that are imposed, yes, sir, by statute.
Representative Kump.
And thank you, Chair McPherson. And I'm trying to get my head wrapped around this. So currently, and anybody here can answer this, no money is being set aside for the intent of this bill for court facilities and, you know, support of any facility management.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kump, at this point in time, the courts are not setting aside or paying into any accounts for this purpose. We simply apply the monies that are collected as we are directed by statutes. For the most part, most courts don't assess interest on their criminal judgments.
Okay.
In my view, that ability has always been present. We have the statutory authority to do it. We've simply never done it.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up, Chair?
You may.
And then the other thing that I'm reaching a conclusion on, if you had to implement this bill on July 7th as previously it put in statute, it will probably cost more money than what we'd make. I mean, we would be in the red rather than in the black.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kump, I believe that is correct. And that's assuming it can be done. I'm not even sure it can be done.
I understand that problem.
I have a question about Section 7 on page 2, the addition of Section 7. Is interest collected on an award of restitution on or after January 1, 2012 must be paid to the person in whose favor the award of restitution is made. That implies that perhaps we're not now channeling any interest to the victim who's the beneficiary of a restitution judgment?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. We are not now assessing interest or paying interest on behalf of victims.
And what's the thinking around the January 1, 2012 date?
I'm going to defer to Paul Snyder because I believe he's more versed with that, or Ms. Click, one of the two.
Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Click is in a better position to answer.
Ms. Click, you should identify yourself for the record.
Yes, I just realized I did not do that earlier. I apologize. For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator. Chair McPherson, 2012 was a compromise date right now with the Department of Justice on the hope that the financial systems and the case management systems for which we have a technology package for the legislature are funded and are up and running by that period of time so that we would have our capacity to do this.
So what happens currently is that it's the victims are owed only the principal amount of the restitution judgment. No, the interest on a restitution judgment doesn't go to the particular victim. Rather, under the statute, where it would go allocated in these other ways. Is that right?
Chair McPherson, each of the state courts and the justice and muni courts have some different capacities in different areas. In the state courts, no interest is collected for any of the criminal accounts, restitution included.
I see.
Because of our systems right now.
Okay. Let me throw out a suggestion, just to try to keep it simple, but have some kind of recognition that these very long duration restitution judgments will be distorted if too long runs, they continue for too long accruing interest. 2 years ago, we extended the duration of restitution judgments from 20 years to 50 years. What if we were to use the 9% that's proposed here, but provide that after 20 years, no more interest accrues. So in effect, it's 9% along with everything else for 20 years. And then at the end of 20 years, no more interest. Then it's whatever dollar figure, principal and interest, has accrued at that point, is then a set amount. And of course, 20 years later, not too many offenders are still going to be working off their restitution judgment, but there may be an occasional one. Somebody who is a young person, you know, messes up and has turned their life around and having set the bar on an obligation. I think there's something positive about them seeing that obligation, but not chasing something that's a receding, goal that they can finally meet. And I have no idea, just in pure economic terms, if it did take them 50 years, how this 12.5 and 4 compares in terms of the amount of interest accrued as opposed compared to 9% for 20 years and 0 for thereafter. But just in terms of sort of a rough cut at it, does that make sense?
Mr. Chairman, Judge Lemhouse, I think that's an entirely workable solution.
Okay.
It would work for the courts, I'm certain.
Okay. Ms. Glick?
Chairman Pearson, that would work for our situation, and I believe the collectors as well.
And Mr. Chair, and maybe I didn't articulate myself very well before, but that is exactly what we were trying to propose earlier. So we would be very happy with that.
Okay.
Council Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm just scribbling some notes here along those lines. I'm looking at the bill, and if we went to line 6 and removed the brackets and said, notwithstanding RRS 82.010, judgments and criminal actions bear interest at the rate of 12% per annum for the date of entry of the judgment for the first 20 years and no interest thereafter.
It wouldn't be 12%, it would be 9% is the rate.
9%.
Or it could be the interest at the rate provided and with a cross-reference the way it is down below.
Mr. Chair, I think if you just looked at line 12, you could possibly simply add at the end of that line for a period not to exceed 20 years.
Okay. Well, we'll defer to legislative council to decide exactly how they think the word should read, but let's go with that concept then, if that seems like a reasonable thing to pursue.
Mr. Chair, we still haven't addressed the judge's recommendation that we pay principal first.
And that would be in the bill. And my, I don't have a problem with that. Is it other people in the committee have concerns about that
I like
approach? I think that's a reasonable way to go.
Just to clarify, upon the judge's recommendation, principal first, as a victim, that means I would get money first that I'm not getting today?
Right.
Because as a victim, I'm not getting the interest anyways, right?
The interest is currently not being collected, I think that whatever is being paid is actually being credited to principal now. But if we don't act, then what the current law says is interest is paid first, and that wouldn't go to the victim under current law.
Good. I understand that, and that's fine. I guess where I'm confused now is that I have this vision in my head that we don't have a software system that allows us to do any of this already anyway, so maybe I'm really confused. We came here because we couldn't implement this, or we haven't been able to implement this. We just changed some things around. Can we implement this now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, with the modifications that we're proposing with House Bill 2311, we believe we can make it work.
One more thing. So where's the interest going to go, though?
Chairman McPherson, Representative Cameron, the way the interest is going to be paid is interest on judgments that are entered in circuit courts, Court of Appeals, Supreme Court, Tax Court, will be paid to a state account. Interest that is collected in a justice court will be paid to the county treasurer. Interest that is collected in a municipal court will be paid to the city treasury. Presently, under the bill, the monies that are collected in interest on judgments in the circuit court, Court of Appeals, Supreme Court, Tax Court, are paid to the crime victims assistance account.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, and I want to understand this. Why can we not, if now we have a system that allows us to take that interest and pay it somewhere, why can we not pay it to the court construction account? since that's an issue that is going to come before this body.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, as far as the courts are concerned, I don't think anybody cares. Where you send that money? The compromise that was reached in the work group that proposed this legislation involved the victims, and much of the interest that was anticipated being collected was anticipated being available for the victims.
I think the policy issue here is that it was envisioned that there would be a larger flow of dollars that could have a meaningful impact on court facilities, and I think the experience is that it isn't really having a meaningful impact on court facilities, that those needs are so much greater than what the amounts that are at issue here, even if they could be collected. And so that's why other funding sources are being explored. Am I characterizing that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I believe so. If you look at the second exhibit that I submitted as an aid to my testimony, it deals with the revenue stream that could possibly be expected from the interest on criminal judgments. And what I've used are, this is the interest that could be possibly accrue on criminal judgments in the circuit courts. And I've used the amount that is collected by the Department of Revenue other agency accounts collections for the Judicial Department as the basis for making these projections, because the revenue that is collected by the Department of Revenue for the Judicial Department is all from delinquent accounts. And so these accounts would all be bearing interest. There would have probably been no waiver of any interest on these accounts. And so these delinquent accounts could, in theory, then produce interest at a 9% per annum rate. Generally, however, you don't collect everything that you're entitled to collect, and so you have to sort of figure out, well, what am I really going to get? Well, because we're starting at zero in the next biennium, probably the most that you could expect to see from interest in the 2007-2009 biennium is maybe $1 million or $1.5 million at the most. I don't see how you could possibly get more than that. The maximum in that biennium would be about $4.5 million, but there's no way you're going to get that because you're starting from zero and then going up to an equilibrium amount. The equilibrium amount is going to be someplace below the 9% statutory rate. And it would take probably two or three biennium before you'd finally get to a somewhat stabilized equilibrium amount. And it would probably be somewhere around between 5 and 7% actually, of what the principal amount is being collected, not the 9%. Does that make any sense? Probably not.
Well, I think the relevance I'm taking from it is that it's not going to have a significant impact at those levels compared to the courthouse facilities needs at the state. So that giving this up as a source for court facilities, it is not as though if we keep this channel to court facilities that we don't have to look at other funding sources to deal with the condition of our courthouses.
Right.
Okay. That's on Monday, Thursday. What I would suggest we do is to have amendments prepared to this bill to deal with that long-term interest issue. And then to bring it back the same day, we were scheduled next Thursday to hear that court facilities bill. And then we can kind of bring those two ideas together and maybe get a fuller debate with a committee maybe closer to full strength on that policy choice about court facilities and how we pay for them. Would that meet the needs of sort of an orderly consideration of the issues?
Sure.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you, panel, for giving us a lot of time here and energy and developing the understanding of this bill. That concludes the hearing on House Bill 2311, which I'll close now, and that concludes our agenda for the Friday, the 2nd of March. We are adjourned.
I think it's 2857.